Are you strung out on streaming?
Did Netflix and chill turn into boring and ill?
Well, fear not, neighbor. We got what you need.
That's right. Your local video store is here to save the day.
We got all the tapes and laserdiscs you never knew you wanted.
That's right. And thanks to modern technology and a 56 kilobyte DSL line, we are able to make film recommendations via the information superhighway, the internet.
Yes. Each month, we pick a random caller seeking help from our trained staff to find a film that meets their search criteria, such as...
horror films directed by a woman with no nudity. Killer doll movies not made by Charles Band.
Even Easter-themed horror films and children with magic. We can help you find what you're looking for.
Can you help me find Jesus?
No, but we can find you religious films not featuring Jesus.
So tune in each week and we'll help you find what it is you're looking for. Find us where all popular podcasts are found, even live recorded video from our store.
Support your local video store and earn a free bag of popcorn when you sign up for a Videorama membership.
Welcome to Videorama!
Are you all right?
Goddamn swinger!
Dead. Good. Paul, there is nearly $500 here.
These swinger types always seem to have money.
Well, now it's ours. You want his watch?
Thanks.
Do you realize that we have made almost $1,000 in 2 days, tax-free?
Just by killing people.
Horrible sex-crazed maniacs that nobody in the world would miss. I wonder how much we could make if we really put our minds to it.
What do you mean?
The city is full of rich perverts. If somehow we could get them to come to the apartment...
Okay, why would they? We'd have to lure them with...
sex.
But you wouldn't really have to. I mean, you wouldn't actually do anything.
Of course not. The minute they try anything dirty, you pop them in the head, get rid of them like you did with this guy.
Mary, how would we contact them? We don't know anything about this swinger business.
Ask someone who does.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with some background thrown on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job right, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. This week, we are kicking off a month of lip-smackin' fun that we have cheekily dubbed Tastes Like Chicken. That's our take on some interesting films that cover the oh-so-fun topic of cannibalism. And what better way to roll that theme out than by starting with Paul Bartel's offbeat cult comedy, 1982's Eating Raoul. Join us! Now, this was a movie that I didn't see until I was well into my college years. A film that I had passed countless times as I walked by, as it stood on the shelf at my local mom-and-pop video store, without giving it any thought other than, yeah, that's that movie, I've seen that poster. And honestly, back in the day, I had nothing against the film, I didn't have anything against the director. It was just literally something I hadn't put any thought towards. I would walk by it, see the cover art, and just go, huh, and keep going. That is, until one faithful day, I was over at my then-girlfriend's house, chatting it up with the woman who would eventually become my mother-in-law, and we were commenting on cult movies. We're talking about pictures that were done by, you know, directors like Ed Wood and John Waters. And she pointed out that she had always liked that one movie. You know the one where they want to open up the restaurant and they have to deal with all of those swingers? I, not having seen the film, I didn't know what she was talking about. That is, until my future father-in-law passed through the kitchen, where we were sitting, on his way to get a beverage, and he threw the name out, and he goes, "She's talking about eating Raoul." So, what do? I figure, well, if she likes it, this probably is something worth looking into. I go back to school, and I go to my mom and pop store, and I rent it for myself. And it was some adorable silly fun. Frivolous filth. High-minded sleaze, with just a touch of lunacy to keep things on the right track. Truly, I loved it. I thought it was very funny. But it got the ball rolling for me. It got me more interested in the director, writer, actor who created the film to begin with. And so, as we go and start to look at this week's film, we gotta first talk about the man behind it. Mr. Paul Bartel. Paul Bartel was born August 6, 1938, to Bill and Jesse Bartel within Brooklyn, New York. Bill was an advertising copywriter, but he ended up relocating the family to a quieter location in Nutley, New Jersey, where Paul was a toddler. Paul was the oldest of four children, and by most accounts, he had, for all outward appearances, a semi-happy childhood. He was a precocious, artistic, and creative child from the get-go. He loved movies. He loved performing in front of others, putting on shows for family and friends. He was obsessed with cartoons, drawing, puppetry, and all things related to making movies. His father had bought him a camera when he got into high school, and once there, he managed to con a very giving art teacher to allow him to work on a personal project for the school year. One where he utilized the rest of his high school art class. You see, Paul had talked them into allowing him to animate his very own cartoon. Paul was going to take care of all the main animatics, but what he would do then is force his classmates to do all of the background cell tracing, you know, all the tedious work, which amounted to over 3,000 cell plates being needed to be gone over. Still, it got done, and Paul was lauded as being a kid genius. That said, though, again, on the surface, everything was great. Beneath, things were a bit more tough, let's say. See, Bartel was having a rough go as he aged, simply because at the age of 10, he knew that he himself was gay. He also quickly learned that his family was not going to be supportive of that fact, which forced a young Paul to hide his identity away from his family and friends. And in the long run, that caused him as a youth a great deal of mental anguish. Bartel would end up graduating from high school in 1956, and wisely he got as far away from home as possible, enrolling at UCLA to study theater arts. He wrote plays, he acted in projects, made student films, made fast friends, and finally felt that he was comfortable enough in his own skin to both publicly admit to himself and to his family that he was indeed a homosexual. He made, at the time, what would become a tragic mistake to come out to his parents and siblings in 1958. Now, I say tragic not because he was going to admit he himself was gay, but because their reaction too was considered to be very normal for the day. They withdrew him from school and they forcibly committed him to psychiatric care, an early form of conversion therapy which lasted for over a year, because obviously, clearly, as far as they were concerned, young Paul was mentally ill. Who would ever claim to be homosexual? Now, for his part, Bartel never wavered in his resolve, and he never said, "Nope, anything other than I'm gay." He never acquiesced, he never renounced how he felt, but this therapy that lost him a year out of his life, and it put him through a great deal of personal suffering. And it caused him to have a bunch of self-loathing, and it permanently strained his relationships with his family. Going forward, Bartell decided he was going to keep a lot of his business to himself, and he was never going to open himself up that way to his family again. Finally, free of being under care in 1959, Bartell went back to school and was able to regain his independence and return to his studies. He had picked up a Romance language minor, which allowed him to become both fluent in French and Italian, and once more, his skills in 1961 got him a Fulbright scholarship to continue to study art in Rome, where he had the fortune to make short films abroad. Bartell returned to the States, and much to his horror, he found himself drafted into the U.S. Army, a concept that he abhorred and thought was going to drive him to having a nervous breakdown. Lucky for him, though, the Army would actually be a blessing for Bartell's career. You see, he was assigned to the Signal Corps Picture Center in Long Island. That was the division that ended up making all the training films for the rest of the Army, and the military at large. Bartell got to live in the city, he got to act, write, direct films for the U.S. government, and in his off time, he got to hang out and vibe on the 60s art scene in the heart of New York. He saw avant-garde cinema, he took in underground pictures at Times Square, and he got to network with a large number of actors, writers, and artists. By 1965, Bartell was out of the service and he got himself a job working as an assistant production manager for Rose Madwood Productions Incorporated, an ad firm that made television commercials. He wasn't happy with his day job, but he did manage to make use of collecting all of the unused short ends from the projects that they were working on. Well, he was stealing those short ends. That, and he was taking them from fellow independent creators who would often moonlight shooting adult loops for various grindhouses in the city. Any film that wasn't used, any of that negative, those small pieces they cut off the end of the reel, those are short ends. And Bartell would collect those because he couldn't afford to buy film himself. Piecing those all together, he could make movies on his own. From collecting those film short ends, he was able to make a film on the side, and he wrote and shot in 1966 a little movie he called Secret Cinema. It was shot guerrilla style whenever he could afford to do so throughout the city. It's interesting. It's a short story about a woman named Jane who's unknowingly the subject of a documentary film production, and everybody in her life is in on it except for her. Her fiancé, her friends, her family, they all know about it. And it's so disquieting that she begins to question her own reality. Think of it as an early version of The Truman Show, shot decades before, and the whole thing cost about $5,000 to make. Bartell would shoot the film without any audio, and he'd have to dub in all of the dialogue and the sound later just to save cash. But by the end of the year, it was complete, and he got to get the film screened in both London and in a local New York film festival. When it played in New York City, it was part of an art house double feature that was showing another little movie called Murder à la Mode by a plucky young guy that Bartell hit it off with. No-name guy, you've probably never heard of him, Brian De Palma. It was there he was also introduced to an actress working the area at the time who would become his future muse and frequent collaborator, Mary Woronoff. Bartell took a new job and he went to work for the Hearst Metrotone News Corporation, where he would end up staying for the next 3 years honing his craft. Again, during this time, he was collecting all the film that he could, and he managed to cobble together another short film during this same period. It was a sexy little artistic comedy that he entitled The Naughty Nurse. And while the subject matter itself was a running trope use of the concept of a threesome, there was actually no sex to be had in the story. The setup is strange. It's a cop who interrupts a couple in a seedy motel, and the couple ends up drawing the officer in for their own entertainment. The film, though, twist ends where all three are seen suddenly in medical clothes, standing around an operating table, alluding to the notion that these are just three very strange medical professionals who are all sharing a fantasy role-playing scenario. And it ends with the doctor telling the nurse that things went so well, perhaps next time she will get to play the role of the cop. Bartel was able to make the picture and even put in a little bit of some big-name talent for the day. For instance, he had Robert Downey Sr. have a small role in the story. The short also made waves as the actor who played the police officer, and was later revealed to be a doctor, the actor Chris St. John, he was an African-American man, and of course he's interacting with a white couple. And that was a bold interracial concept for 1969. Again, even though nothing is seen, it's just a comedy that they're alluding to sex. Bartel ended up quitting his job, and he decided that he was going to make films full-time, picking up cash from various acting gigs and working all the while to get his own pictures made. 1970, he got a small part in Brian De Palma's movie Hi Mom, featuring Robert De Niro, which was a sequel to his previous De Niro outing, a picture called Greetings. Bartel ended up throwing all of his energy and cash into writing, producing, and directing his next film. Something that would turn out to be sort of a kinky horror movie that was unfortunately called Private Parts. Now, on the plus side, it got him noticed in the industry, and it put him on the radar of the one and only Roger Corman. The downside is Private Parts itself was an interesting concept within the industry. It was part of a wave of movies that were coming up. Corman himself was making them at the time. Folks wanted some scandalous material that they could release as B-movies. Even the major studios wanted to get in on the action because it was lucrative. So you have MGM come calling. They want to be a distributor for this small independent picture. But unfortunately for Bartel, once they get their hands on it, they just don't know how to approach marketing the film. See, Private Parts, which is not a bad movie, involves, well, the plot itself, without revealing too much, involves a young woman who goes to live with her aunt and her cousin, and she basically finds out that her cousin himself is sort of perverted. He basically collects human-sized dolls, and he may or may not be a murderer. Oh, and the two of them strike up a relationship. So it's this strange comedy horror movie that has a touch of incest to it. MGM doesn't know what they're actually going to do, and ultimately they backed out of having a full-on distribution release. Instead, they shuffled it off on one of their lesser outlet studios, a little studio called Premier Pictures, and that left Bartel basically alone trying to promote his own indie movie, and that was all on him. So it's going to come out, but nobody is going to advertise for it. It's going to have to be word of mouth, and that pretty much made the film guaranteed to be unsuccessful. It had some interesting reviews and some genuine likes from some critics, but at the end of the day, it was not at all something that was viable, and Bartel was forced to eat the loss of the picture, but again, for the record, not a bad movie. Having worked with Corman's brother Gene during his time with MGM, Bartel would end up going over to New World Studios to directly ask Corman to just give him a job. Let me get in, let me direct something for you, I can make it work. Corman was already impressed with how Bartel had operated, just with his past track record, but he had never worked for Corman, so wisely, Corman gave him like a second unit gig working under director Steve Carver and put him on the 1973 Bonnie and Clyde ripoff, Big Bad Mama. Great movie. Angie Dickinson, Tom Skerritt, William Shatner, future episode for sure. The movie itself saw a profit, and Bartel proved to be very steady. He impressed Carver, he impressed Corman, so of course Corman gave him a hand at making his next picture. He gave him 1975's Death Race 2000. Bartel was going to have to overhaul the script, he was going to have to direct, but he'd be given $5,000 to take care of everything. And that was going to be used as a vehicle to go up against the soon-to-be-released movie Rollerball with James Caan. They needed their own cheap, crazy action movie that would draw people in who might want to go see James Caan play a strange futuristic game. So what do? They come up with a strange, violent, futuristic cross-country car race. The film was also going to give star David Carradine a chance to get away from his kung fu television career and transition fully into making films. Bartel, for his part, was able to get friends and fellow actors like Voronov on board, plus he got to work with young Sylvester Stallone, Don Steele, and John Landis. The shoot, though, on Death Race 2000 was rather hard. The turnaround time was rather tight, and Bartel had to continually battle with both Carradine, who was throwing a star trip, which was interesting since it was his first picture, and with Corman over just the content of the film. See, Bartel saw this script as an action comedy, very strong emphasis on the comedy. It was a cartoon made for adults. Corman wanted to ditch a lot of the humor and stick with just the action. As director Joe Dante would tell it years later, Corman wanted all this action highlighted, so in the end, he went into the editing bay and he cut the film the way he wanted, which was a different version than from what Paul gave, and he excised all those comedic scenes. And since the film turned around and was financially successful, Corman would go on later to tout, "See, I was right, all was justified." Bartel would turn around and shoot yet another action film right after, again for Roger Corman and yet again starring David Carradine, releasing the fun film Cannonball the next year in 1976. Bartel also upped his own acting game, dropping into his fellow Corman school director's projects. He shows up in Ron Howard's Grand Theft Auto. He was in Jonathan Kaplan's Mr. Billion. He showed up for a small role in Joe Dante's Piranha. And he was in Alan Arkush's Rock and Roll High School. As the decade closed out, though, Bartel was really growing tired of working for other people. He wanted to make films his way. He was tired of compromising. In 1980, he started to work on his next project, a project that would become this week's film. He took on a writing partner with friend Richard Blackburn. They had crafted a dark little comedic story about a married couple who are very uptight. They're these middle-class snobs who are both extremely polite yet certifiably insane with their desires to start their own restaurant. To afford their dream, they begin preying on swingers and take on a partner who brings an entirely new dynamic into their own relationship. The title Eating Raoul was chosen, according to co-writer Blackburn, because, well, while everyone else thought it sounded like porn, it was better than all of the previous working treatments that were floated around beforehand. Stuff like World of Swingers and other inappropriate things were considered. Now, Roger Corman would go on to tell that he had passed on Eating Raoul. He liked the concept, but he didn't think the project was going to be commercial enough to see a profit. He did, though, give his famous feedback to Bartel, letting him know what he did like about the idea and what he thought was worth keeping, and he did compliment him on the film's humor. As Bartel would recount later, though, while he appreciated Corman's input, he didn't want the man to finance the project. As Bartel would say, whenever you need to complete a job, Corman would give you half of that amount, and he'd tell you to make do with it. Bartel was done making do. He was going to get the money he needed, and he would do it his way. Well, his way included taking out a loan from his family. He ended up raising $300,000, mainly from the sale of his parents' home, just to get his comedy made. He had a bunch of industry friends pitch in. Joe Dante contributed a bunch of short ends that he was using while working on The Howling in 1981, just to let Bartel complete the movie. For 18 months, this film got shot mostly on weekends in and around Los Angeles, with Bartel begging, borrowing, and stealing to shoot all he could before lack of funds would again shut things down. Bartel actually really wanted Paul Rubens, you know, Pee-wee Herman, to appear as the sleazy owner of an adult novelty store. And while the comedian loved the idea, he did politely decline the opportunity. But the part was given to his friend, the late John Paragon, you know, Jombi from Pee-wee's Playhouse. Still, Bartel was able to put together a hell of a cast here. Bartel himself would play the main character Paul Bland. Mary Woronov would be on board to play his equally pretentious wife, Mary Bland. Actor Robert Beltran was cast to play the awkward partner in crime, the romantic rival of Mary's affections, as Raul Mendoza. Susan Sager was on to play Doris the Dominatrix, while Ed Begley Jr. was cast as an aging hippie. And you even have a young Edie McClurg showing up here as one of the swingers who the Blands end up eliminating for money. You had the great character actor Richard Paul cast as a persnickety liquor store owner, Mr. Cray. And you had the great comic writer and actor Buck Henry. He was cast as a lusty bank manager. Throw in cameos from John Landis, Joe Dante, Charles B. Griffin, and Robert V. Barron, and you got yourself a hell of a lineup of talent here. But I'll say this, geez, folks, you've heard enough of my yakking already. How's about we get to the trailer for the movie? What do you say?
Meet Paul and Mary Bland.
Hey, you two live in the building. You must swing, right?
Wrong. Good night.
We're so lucky to have found each other.
A typical American couple.
I know. Good night, dear.
Sweet dreams.
With a typical American dream and typical American problems.
You are through at Clay Liquor.
Mr. Leach, I'm sure the bank has nothing to worry about. It's going to get everything that's coming to it.
The bank wants to see what it's getting into.
For the Blands, life was just a rat race.
A cartoon mouse.
Oh, great. Trigger likes you already.
Oh, we like B and D, but we don't like S&M. We met at the A&P.
But they found a way to beat it. Until...
Mr. Raul Mendoza, como esta usted?
They met a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano.
I'm a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano.
Eating Raul. Is it a thriller? Is it a romance?
This was very wrong.
Is it a tragedy?
Excuse me. May I sit down?
Is it a comedy?
Yes, but not the type that you're used to.
Eating Raul, rated R.
Paul and Mary Bland are uptight, middle-class L.A. dwellers with grand dreams. Paul, as played by Bartell, is a fussy wine snob who works at a cheap liquor store in Los Angeles, mocking the winos he routinely has to sell to and using his connections to purchase extravagant and expensive bottles of wine for the restaurant he plans to open one day with his wife, Mary. Mary, as played by Woronov, is a nurse who works the graveyard shifts at local hospitals, whose frigid air is tested daily as she is hit on by almost every creep of a man she encounters. It's only the platonic love that Paul provides that makes her happy, and their shared prudishness and snobbery complements each other so well. They live in a rather nice apartment in a rather dilapidated building that's been taken over by floor upon floor of residents who are all liberated swingers, much to the Bland's disgust. They are closing in on their goal of getting enough money together to make their dream happen of both buying a home and opening up their own restaurant when they encounter two major setbacks. First, Paul has an argument with his boss, Mr. Cray, as played by Richard Paul, over a case of expensive wine that he ordered, which leads to his subsequent firing.
Really? Stomach cramps? It's such a good buy.
Well, so is lighter fluid at $1.50 a pint, but I wouldn't serve it to my dinner guests. Forget about Mountain Brook.
My dinner date wouldn't know the difference anyway.
How about a nice Beaujolais? I'm sure it would go very well with your meat.
How much?
$3.50 plus tax.
All right, I'll take it on your say-so.
Now, you be sure to let me know if you're not completely satisfied.
With wine, you mean?
Bland, D.
Did you refuse to sell that customer a bottle of Mountain Brook?
I certainly did. It's undrinkable.
I'm not interested in your opinion, Mr. Gourmet. If a customer wants a brand of wine that we carry, that's what he gets.
Mr. Cray, I tried a bottle of Mountain Brook. It made me sick.
Well, it makes me three times as sick if I get stuck with those 10 cases we got piled up downstairs.
I think this man...
And another thing. Who told you to order a case of Chateau Lafite Rothschild? This stuff goes for $400 a bottle. We don't have customers for that kind of item. You got your head up your ass?
Mr. Cray, I think... This is...
Excuse me, one of you gentlemen mind giving me the money out of that cash register?
What?
I said give me the money out of the register, sucker, and make it fast.
Mr. Cray, you killed him.
Yeah. Now, how about that Chateau Lafite?
Mary equally has problems when she attempts to secure a loan from their bank. The manager, Mr. Leach, as played by Buck Henry, purposely gives her the runaround, offering to see what he can do on her and Paul's behalf, in exchange, of course, for sexual favors from Mary, which are immediately rebuffed. Worried that they won't be able to afford their regular bills, Paul plans on selling a few bottles of his most expensive wine, but he ends up getting ripped off by the buyer. One night, as a wild party rages on the same floor as them, a drunken swinger, played by Gary Goodrow, accidentally enters the Bland apartment and assumes that Mary, in her nurse outfit, is a fellow enjoyer of the lifestyle. Unable to comprehend that he's in the wrong place, he attempts to assault Mary, which ends with Paul striking the man over the head with a cast iron frying pan, inadvertently killing him. They discuss and try to rationalize the matter away, all while awaiting their real estate agent to arrive for dinner.
Mary, look at this. Huh? This guy is a junior officer at the Bank of San Fernando. He must have $600 here.
Ed Fosley Jr., credit card division. You suppose he's the one that canceled our credit card?
James!
What did I say? Put that back. Take the money and put that back where you found it.
But Mary, what if they go through the wallet? What if the police go through the wallet and find the money missing?
You leave a little bit of the money and they don't mind.
I don't want to leave any of the money.
Paul!
Mary, this guy threw up on our card, but he canceled our Instacash card. He owes us at least $600.
Just a minute!
$600, Mary. Think of it, $600. I could buy a lot of things. I'm not going to put that
money. Okay, don't put the money back. Just go out there and make sure that James does not come in here.
What am I going to say?
Well, give him a drink. Make small talk.
I can't make small talk.
Oh, you can now. Get out there and just be calm.
After their company leaves, they take their victim's cash and his body is thrown into the garbage compactor. The Blands then stumble on what they feel could be a new lucrative business, a way to help them get all the money they need to secure their dream house and their dream restaurant. They'll bump off rich perverts. After discussing the matter as to how to actually advertise such parties with local swinger Doris the Dominatrix, as played by Sager, Paul and Mary place ads in the local Hollywood press, and they visit sex shops to spread the word they're open for business. Mary is the bait. And when strange men come to the apartment, they are met with Paul and his frying pan. The money comes rolling in. More than they have made when Paul was having a real job and when Mary works hers. So they invest in hiring a locksmith to come and fix their apartment door and protect their newfound investments, as well as their precious and rare wine that they've hidden throughout the apartment. The problem? The locksmith, who comes to service them, Raul Mendoza, as played by Robert Beltran, is a thief who returns to the apartments that he installs locks in to rob them. He discovers the corpse of one of the victims, and when he confronts the Blands on their behavior, he reveals that he wants in on their action.
I gotta hand it to you. You guys got a very original scam going here.
Well, it was mostly Mary's idea.
Paul's just being modest.
It is so sweet to see such a loving couple as yourselves. Now, about this proposition...
We're not interested.
Calmate, cabrón. You want the money? I'll give you back the money. All I want is the cadavers.
The what?
The bodies. What do you want them for?
That's my business. But I'm going to split it with you 50-50. You take the cash, you give me everything else. We're going to make a nice profit, $200-$300 for each of us.
That's ridiculous.
It's a deal. Just think, no more trash compactor.
Mary, how do we know he won't just go to the police?
Yeah, right, pendejo. I'm a fucking professional thief, man.
Well, all right. We'll give you the two bodies we have on hand at the moment. You see what you can do with them. Then in a few days, if you bring back the money, we'll have some more for you. Now, do we get the cash back?
But of course.
Thus, a deal is struck. Raoul will keep his mouth shut, Paul and Mary get to keep the cash, and Raoul will get any of the possessions found, as well as disposing the bodies, and the three of them, in theory, will split any of the proceeds from the sales of the victims' vehicles. The plan goes along swimmingly, and again, all parties start to see money. Raoul flirts with Mary and makes her uncomfortable, but Paul doesn't really seem to pay it any mind. While Paul is out one evening shopping for groceries and a new, not-for-killing frying pan, a rogue swinger comes into the apartment, as played by Ed Begley Jr., and forces his way in, attempting to rape Mary. Raoul comes in and ends up rescuing Mary, strangling the man to death with his own beads. After the commotion dies down, Raoul and Mary end up splitting a joint together, and they end up falling into bed, something that Mary, to her own surprise, greatly enjoys, but demands must never happen again. Paul becomes suspicious of Raoul as well, not just for the constant flirting with Mary, but for the fact that the returns on their shared investments don't seem to be adding up. He follows Raoul, and he learns that the young man is selling the bodies to be made into dog food. That's money he's been pocketing. And he's selling off all the victims' vehicles and keeping the bulk of the cash for himself. Raoul, for his part, becomes obsessed with Mary, coming to her workplace, telling her that he loves her and wants her to leave Paul for him and run away. Mary rebuffs him at first, citing that Paul and her have been married for 10 years. They love each other. They have shared goals. But she still gives in to her lust for Raoul and sleeps with him again. Raoul does attempt to run Paul down with his car, but fails, causing Paul to declare war on his new rival. Paul ends up hiring Doris to go through with a number of harassing schemes to try to make Raoul's life a living hell, which includes making him think that he's being profiled by immigration services, as well as pretending to be a nurse who diagnoses him with a fake venereal disease and then prescribes him saltpeter in an effort to render him impotent. Raoul does suffer a little bit, but that doesn't stop his pursuit of cutting out Paul and winning over Mary. The Blands do happen to come across the perfect property to purchase for their dream restaurant. It will become the location of Paul and Mary's Country Kitchen. But they do fear they're going to lose the opportunity if they don't buy it fast. Reasoning that they can go for one big score, the Blands decide they're going to cut Raoul out entirely. They go to a swingers party undercover, planning on bumping off the lot of the attendees. Mary, when she's separated from Paul, runs into Mr. Leach, who comes on to her again, and she ends up stabbing him in a bedroom with a rat tail comb and throwing his body out the window, trying to get some both much-wanted vengeance and wanting to pocket the man's cash. Knowing that Leach is very wealthy, the couple attempt to get down to where his body is lying, but the swinging host demands that all guests strip down and get into his hot tub. And that's the point when the quiet and demure Paul loses his temper, and he ends up throwing in a plugged space heater to the tub, eliminating all of the randy party guests. From the money, the personal goods, the bodies, the cars, Paul and Mary end up making a mint, and now they have everything they need to open their restaurant. As they prepare to have their real estate agent James, played by writer Richard Blackburn, over to sign the papers, they prepare him a sampling of their food. That's when a drunken Raoul bursts in, threatening Paul for cutting him out of their latest score, and telling him in no uncertain terms, he's gonna kill Paul, wed Mary, and start a new successful life. Mary fakes as if she supports Raoul, but she ends up luring him into the kitchen to kill him with the frying pan. Mary is apologetic to her husband, both for cheating and for the dishonesty, but Paul admits he already knew, and this was a means to an end. Also, it doesn't matter.
Paul, there's something I never told you. Raoul and I are...
I know.
No.
I know.
Oh, no, Paul, you don't know, because he... You see, what happened is he forced me to smoke this drug, and then he raped me. And then he told me that if I didn't continue to have relations with him, that he was going to tell you. I couldn't let anyone hurt you. And so we continued...
He deserved everything he got.
With James arriving soon and no good meat on hand to cook for him, the two end up looking at each other and then at the body of Raoul on the floor. When James arrives, they make the deal to purchase their dream home, and James compliments them, looking forward to eating such fine food at their new restaurant, commenting that he loves the French cuisine that they've made for him, with Mary quickly correcting, "Actually, it's Spanish." As the three toast, Paul makes the comment, "It's amazing what you can do with some cheap cuts of meat." And Mary, complimenting his fine wine, agrees with him. Credits roll. So, I mean, where do we begin unpacking all of this? I mean, truly, Bartel is and has always been in a class of his own when it comes to playing an officious or a fussy character. He just has the uptight white guy act down pat. He does it with that great humorless flat stare of his, constantly wearing those brown and muted toned suits and the ever-present bow ties. He's just this perfect walking satire of uptight whiteness from the early 80s. The same people who considered themselves to be the silent majority of Nixonian America, who now made modern, at least for the time, again at the dawn of Reagan. He wants fine things. He wants to have things always seemingly be perfect, and he's disgusted by the libertine values that he finds himself surrounded by. In short, Paul Bland thinks he's better than everybody else, but he just can't prove it. His dream of a successful restaurant with Mary is his way of showing the world he's worth something, where his Epicurean tastes and his knowledge of fine wine will be appreciated by like-minded people, who of course will then give him business and adoration. As a character, I love Paul Bland. He is so amazingly realized. He's a self-aggrandizing coward, a man who is both nice to a fault, yet is terribly, terribly ruthless.
I will show you black.
Oh, what an ordeal. I thought he would never stop talking.
Nobody can say we don't earn this money.
A check? I told him not to bring a check.
After this, no more actors, okay? Why don't you go to bed, honey? I'll bag the Nazi and straighten up around here.
Okay. I'll see you in a little while. Good night.
I will say, I think it's interesting that the underlying elephant in the room is that Paul Bland, at least without saying it, is clearly a gay man married to a straight woman. I mean, Donna the Dominatrix picks up on it almost immediately when she hints that, you know, you guys can sell yourself out, noting that Paul would be a great draw for some bears, and he doesn't really go for it. Mary and Paul do love each other. They're the greatest of friends. They're partners in life. They have shared goals of culinary greatness. But look at how they personify their uptight situation. They sleep in separate twin beds, they share platonic love, and they both agree out loud that sexual relations are dirty. But in reality, this seems to just be a marvelous way of justifying Paul's own homosexuality and Mary's general disdain towards men. Paul is just a bastion of good manners and positive treatment, especially when every man that Mary meets just paws at her, reinforcing her hatred of people who are not her and Paul. Still, she uses this frigidity as a crutch, denying her own wants and needs for the greater good of the shared dream, at least the one she has with Paul. That is all, though, put to the test when the facade cracks and Mary is offered up some lusty times and excitement in her life with the addition of Raoul. Paul and Mary might share that dream of success, their very own restaurant, their country kitchen, but with Raoul, whether he knows it or not, he gives Mary something that's visceral and carnal, and you can see that, at least for a brief time, she's tempted by this.
Raoul, I agreed to see you because I think that we should discuss what happened the other night.
Yeah. That's all I've been thinking about for 3 days.
It was a mistake. That's all. I don't want you to think that it could ever happen again. I'm not about to risk my marriage for the sake of some low animal attraction.
What risk? Your husband's never gonna know.
Guess he will. We know each other too well. He can sense when something's different.
Maybe you're right. Maybe we should go to your husband and tell him everything.
Are you crazy?
Yeah, I'm crazy. About you, Chiquita. I don't care about your husband. I don't care about the money. I don't care about nothing but you.
That's ridiculous.
You don't understand who you're dealing with. I'm a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano.
I think you're a calculating little bastard.
Bastard? All right, then. I'm going to go to your husband and I'm going to tell him everything. And then we'll have to fight for you man to man. A man in love will do anything, and I am a man in love. And I think you're a little bit in love with me, too, huh?
Don't be silly. That's nonsense. I'm not in love with you.
I've seen some people argue that it's truly loyalty that Mary has for Paul that makes her stay, while others have supposed it's flat-out greed that makes Mary ultimately side with her husband. I would like to think it's the former, because she does, in her own way, with some embellishment and lies, apologize to Paul. And she did hold Raoul at arm's length through the entire time, and she continued to support their shared goals the entire way through. For good or ill, Mary threw her lot in with Paul, and together they'll either sink or swim. And no amount of fly-by-night fun is going to change that for her. Now, Beltran, for his part, he's marvelous here. He's clearly having fun with this part. The supporting cast are all cartoons of people, and with all these swinging characters getting to have most of the fun and most of the outrageous scenes. For my money, the hot tub breakdown is when the humor really shines through, and one really can't watch this movie without marveling at all of the amazing work that Buck Henry is doing here. I mean, if you know anything about Buck Henry's personal life, which we'll get into later, this probably wasn't far from the mark. He is clearly chewing the scenery. Now, I selected this film to kick off a month of cannibal films, and I know that's probably a misnomer in this case, especially when you consider that there's only one single instance of anything remotely related to cannibalism happening, and it happens in the closing moments of the film. But since from the title on, you know that either figuratively or literally, someone's gonna be having Raoul, this movie is just too good and too much fun to pass up, and so I thought it would be a fitting way to kind of kick things off with a fun bit of humor, and knowing full well it's not going to bowl anybody over. But in defense of this film, you can sit through it and have a smile on your face the entire time it's playing. And I mean, truly, perhaps that says something both about this film and about me that I can say that happens. But for what it's worth, I find this film to be a delightful romp, and I think more people should see it. I mean, truly, where else are you going to be able to get the House Enchilada?
Paul and Mary Bland announced the opening of their new restaurant.
Mary, if we call it the Country Kitchen, can the specialty still be the Bland Enchilada?
I hope so. It's the best thing I do.
So I can hear you out there right now. Chris, how was the film received? Well, advanced screenings sent test audiences nuts. The movie was sold out each of the times that it played at the Cannes Film Festival in May of 82. The movie was picked up by Fox Classics, and the distribution rights alone made Bartel a cool $400,000 immediately for just signing. The movie opened nationwide October 1st, 1982, coming in to mixed reviews from critics. Some would go on to try to make comparisons that it was a true comedic successor to the murder comedies that the British cranked out, noting other films like Kind Hearts and Coronets or The Lady Killers were in good company with Eating Raoul. Others found it a bit too strange to consider it laugh-out-loud funny. Oddly enough, though, it managed to tickle Vincent Canby of the New York Times, although he himself was quick to point out that while there are moments of real humor, it could be hit or miss for a mass audience. Roger Ebert was of a similar assessment. He wasn't advising people not to see it, but he noted it wasn't going to be for everybody. Variety was quick to point out that while the material could offend in some circles, Bartel has such a light and deadpan approach to this film, it makes what should seemingly be repulsive instead perfectly acceptable. In the end, though, it wouldn't matter. Eating Raoul experienced a word-of-mouth boost, and audiences did come out in the cities that it was released to see it. Eating Raoul had cost ultimately Bartel almost $500,000 after the fact to get it made, but it did over $1 million at the box office, drawing a profit share and setting itself up to be a cult hit, which would again translate to more rentals and buys in the home video market as the years rolled on. Now, what's more, Paul and Mary were so good together that the actors truly had people believing they were in a real relationship together. This was also bolstered by the fact that they would continue to star in films together, often playing couples. Years later, in a 1989 interview with Terry Gross on NPR's Fresh Air, Bartel had a little fun with a hostess who had made the very common on-air mistake of thinking that the two were actually married, which tickled the director to no end. Here's the transcript. Terry Gross. You and your wife star in your movies. Paul Bartel. She's not my wife. Oh, she's not your wife? I'm so sorry. No, she's my friend. She's only my wife in the movies. Gosh, I really thought you were married. No. I guess that means you're not lovers, either. No, I'm gay. She's a painter. As the years would roll on, Bartel would really start to have fun with things. Sometimes during interviews, he would pretend to be very sad, mentioning that Voronoff had divorced him, or she had just recently walked out on him, just to have fun with the interviewer who didn't do their homework and to see what kind of reaction he could get out of them. The pair would end up reprising their roles as the Blands in a marvelous little cameo, showing up in Jim Wynorski's 1986 horror romp, Chopping Mall. And there was for a time talk of actually doing a sequel to Eating Raoul. It was going to be entitled Bland Ambition. Paul and Mary's business would be thriving, but thanks to a disagreement they had with the governor of California over the service he receives at their eatery, Paul is forced to run against him to retaliate against the corrupt politician. I think that would have been an amazingly fun picture to see, but as a project, it ultimately fell apart in 1989 when Vestron Incorporated withdrew its funding, and Bartel was unable to secure new financing from another source. Again, that is a pity. I think that would have been a lot of fun. Now, Bartel did adapt his story into a musical, which would be a stage off-Broadway show of Eating Raoul, which was initially going to go into production in the late 80s, but it did not hit the theater scene until 1992, and then later it would go on to have another revival in London after the director himself passed on. Bartel would go on to make other pictures, both as an actor and a director. His 1984 film, Not for Publication, with David Naughton and Nancy Allen, it's a fun train wreck to take in, but wow, it was a disaster at the box office. He did a send-up of westerns. The name itself mocks the classic nickname given to the 1946 picture, Duel in the Sun. Bartel made his own story, Lust in the Dust, but at least that made its money back in 1985. He scored some critical kudos with writing, directing, and starring in a little movie called Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, and that reunited him both with Beltran and Voronoff again on the big screen. He ended up having cameos and acted in all sorts of crazy parts over the late 80s and early 90s. This is a short list. He appeared in Frankenweenie, Follow That Bird, European Vacation, Into the Night, Killer Party, Munchies, Amazon Women on the Moon, Shakedown, Caddyshack 2, Far Out Man, Gremlins 2 The New Batch, Liquid Dreams, The Usual Suspects, Joe's Apartment, Escape from LA, and that's just me naming a few of the pictures. As the 90s wore on, though, health problems began to plague him. For about 6 months prior to his death, Bartel was just having some vague feeling that something was wrong. He ended up being diagnosed as having liver cancer, but he was actually fairly optimistic about his chances at beating it, and he worked with his doctors and planned for future treatments and surgeries. This optimism was clearly displayed as he continued to work on negotiations and began to map out future projects. In April of the year 2000, the 61-year-old underwent what was considered to be a successful surgery to help remove his cancer. Thus, it came as a great shock to both friends and family when Bartel suddenly died 2 weeks later on May 13th, the result of a massive heart attack, robbing the world of his winking, tongue-in-cheek fussiness and his innate ability to find subversive comedy seemingly everywhere. Bi-coastal memorials were held for Bartel, with actors, directors, and artists of all stripes coming out to pay their respects to him. Roger Corman, who was particularly respectful and fond in his tribute to Bartel, remembered him as being a thoroughly professional and good person. I don't think anyone ever had anything bad to say about Paul. He was well-liked everywhere, and as a director, he got along not only with actors, but the entire crew. He had a successful career, perhaps more so now as an actor, but he was a good director too. The version of Eating Raoul screened here at the LSCE was the 2012 Criterion Edition Blu-ray that comes with some really decent offerings. You get audio commentary from screenwriter Blackburn, as well as production designer Robert Schulenberg and editor Alan Tumayan. It contains both shorts, Secret Cinema and Naughty Nurse, as well as the documentary Cook Up Raoul, all about the making of the film, which also contains interviews from Woronov, Beltran, and McClurg, as well as an archival interview jointly given by Bartel and Woronov from back in the day. Throw in the film's trailer and an essay from critic David Ehrenstein, and you've got yourself some decent bang for your buck here. Now, I will say this, it's a little bit of a head-scratcher. If you want to just buy it on Blu-ray only, Amazon.com has the film listed as currently being $32.93, and while I wouldn't tell you that the movie's not worth it, the curious and confusing part is, if you buy the multi-format disc, which gives you the film on Blu-ray and on DVD with all of the same features, it only costs you $19.99, and that's the better deal for sure. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here to tell you where you should purchase your media at. Truly, we just think it's important in this day and age that people continue to support buying films on physical media so that these fine companies will continue to release the movies that you all know and love. And at the end of the day, isn't that really what you want? Getting more of what you know and love? Besides, Eating Raoul, it's so goofy, so charming, so morbid in its whimsy, I would dare people to try to watch it and not crack a smile. So with that said, what are you waiting for? Get out there and get yourself a copy of Eating Raoul today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Hey, you still can't get enough of having old Chris here in your ears? Well, I was lucky enough to have sat down with the Videorama podcast gang, and we got to discuss a marvelous 80s reality-bending, Lovecraft-inspired horror offering. It was a movie I got to pick, From Beyond. And that's available now for you to take in wherever you listen to your podcasts on. Or, if you'd like to prove that I do indeed have a face for podcasting, you can check out the entire online chat on YouTube today. stop by the website for links, and we can get you hooked up with that for you to enjoy. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts and hit that subscribe button. Or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. You want to leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. Just my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm happy to announce that we've been added to Amazon Music, so if you have an account, simply say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Find us there. Give us a follow and a review if you could, please. And hey, feel free to do that to any of the lists we're a part of. Give us a boost in those rankings. The more reviews and the increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms and it makes us more searchable. And then we can share these films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with us, ask a question, make a comment, send us wonderful things, please email us at lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you'd like to be even more personable or you wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, please send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, please take care out there, wash your hands, wear a mask. Everybody, please stay healthy. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.
Hi, I'm Linda.
And I'm Jane.
And we have a brand new podcast called Bedknobs and Broomflicks, where we talk about witches of the entertainment world. From the horror movies Warlock, Suspiria, The Witch, and The Blair Witch Project,
to the more comedic or whimsical such as Harry Potter, Hocus Pocus, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and The Blair Witch Project.
No movie, TV show, or book is off limits.
All witches, man witches, sorry warlocks, we're not calling you that, witches brews, witches of history, familiars, and witch-like activity will be discussed as we laugh and have fun talking about the wonderful world of witches.
So join us every other week for some fun witchy talk.
All witches welcome.